This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is Tuesday, and we are going to start today with Ask the Doctors. Here in Boston, more than 1,000 city employees could face suspension this week for violating the city's COVID-19 vaccine mandate. Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey announced the mandate back in August.
We have to do all we can to protect ourselves, our families, and the residents we serve.
Employees are required to provide proof of vaccination or receive a negative COVID test every week. The mandate has gone into effect in waves starting last month. And last week, the Janey administration started notifying employees who were out of compliance of the potential consequences beginning today. Meanwhile, hospitals across the state are preparing to fire potentially hundreds of healthcare workers for not complying with their vaccine mandates. And because there's always more, there are new developments in a potential pill for treating COVID, booster shots from Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, vaccine side effects, and more. Are you still with us? Well, if you have questions, now's the time. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. And here to help answer those questions, Dr. Sabrina Asumu, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Boston University School of Medicine and Infectious Disease Specialist at Boston Medical Center, as well as Dr. Helen Boucher, Infectious Disease Physician at Tufts Medical Center and Interim Dean of the Tufts University School of Medicine. Dr. Asumu, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on.
Dr. Boucher, welcome back to you as well.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Tiziana.
So, Dr. Boucher, I'll stay with you for a second. We mentioned the city of Boston's vaccine deadline. You heard me talk about that, proof of vaccination or a negative test every week. Boston officials say about 1,200 workers weren't in compliance as of this weekend. Now, that's out of 18,000 people. So the question is that a win? Only 1,200 out of 18,000? Or is anything short of 100% compliance not enough?
Well, you know, it's a very good question. And I think that, it's on the way to being a win. And we have good evidence now that these mandates actually are very effective in getting people to become vaccinated. So my hope is that that last 1,200 will find their way to yes and get on board with being vaccinated so that they can maintain their important jobs for the city.
Dr. Asumu, the most effective route to getting people who are not yet vaccinated at this point, is it communication? Is it consequences like Boston's preparing for? Is it outreach from close family and friends? You know, you hate to see people lose their jobs and you hate to see critical labor forces be short-staffed right now. Can we move the needle with folks who have yet to be vaccinated? Who could be and have yet to be vaccinated?
Yeah, I think that we need to use all the different tools that we have in our toolbox. I think as Dr. Boucher just said, we've seen that mandates actually work. And if you look at the history and what has actually worked in the past for increasing the rates of vaccination, mandates absolutely work. But the other thing we need to consider is that, you know, during this pandemic, there's been so much misinformation. And so that is why it is so critical for us as healthcare professionals to continue to answer questions and reach to those who have not yet been vaccinated and answer their questions, because people still have questions.
So we actually have a caller calling in with a question about unvaccinated family members. So 1-800-423-8255. This is Ask the Doctors. Now is the time to call with your coronavirus question. We've got Kathy on the line in Cambridge. Kathy, go right ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My mom is 96 years old. She is fully vaccinated and she just got her booster, her Pfizer booster. She is moving in with my sister and my sister's husband, who are both strong anti-vaxxers, and I want to know if she will be safe. We've had tremendous family battles about this, and I'm trying to get an expert opinion.
Kathy, that is a tough situation. Dr. Boucher, obviously you don't know the specific full details of Kathy's mother's medical situation, but what can you tell Kathy?
Yeah, so Kathy, I certainly empathize with you. I think we all have family members who struggle with this, and you know, I would say that it's very good that your mom is fully vaccinated and has had her third dose, but also have to say that she remains at higher risk because of her age. And unfortunately, we know that older folks are at the highest risk of having complications if they do get COVID. So, you know, it's definitely worth continuing to talk to your sister and her husband about the importance of getting vaccinated, if not for themselves, for your mom. And by all means, using appropriate mitigation measures unless and until they are fully vaccinated.
So Drs. Boucher and Asumu, while we still have Kathy, I'm going to ask a follow-up question. You may or may not be able to answer this, but do we know data about the rate of breakthrough cases in older adults in the age bracket that Kathy's mother is? Dr. Asumu, do you know?
So, you know, when you look at breakthrough cases and who are the people who are having breakthrough cases, number one, age is an important factor. A second factor is having an underlying condition. It is hard for me to talk about the specific case, but right. We do know that when we do have breakthrough cases, they're often less than 1%. I mean, we always think about and worry about them, but, you know, we see more breakthrough cases the more people we have vaccinated, but we always need to remember the denominator and that, you know, from what we look at, it's often less than 1%.
I just want to clarify also, when we say we see more breakthrough cases the more people get vaccinated, that's not causality, as you're saying, Dr. Asumu. What that is the overall cases may go down, but as more and more people are vaccinated, the people that you do see who have COVID are going to be disproportionately vaccinated because that's who everyone is, right?
Yes. No, thank you for clarifying. What I didn't mean causality. It's more like, you know, the more people you have vaccinated, then the more likely you have, if you pick a random person, that person is more likely to be vaccinated. So the pool is greater of people who are vaccinated and who are at risk. But yes, vaccinating is the way to go.
Thank you, Dr. Asumu. So Dr. Boucher, we'll pick up the next call for you again then. We've got Mike on the line in Everett. Mike, go ahead.
So I have a question about why there isn't more of a mandate for people that are vaccinated to also be tested. It seems to me, I'm not a medical person, but just going through the logic, the people that get sick that aren't vaccinated are much more likely to notice it because they're less likely to be asymptomatic. And the people that, you know, who've been vaccinated are not going to notice. And even if they get the sniffles, they're like, I'm vaccinated. Why should, you know, I can't have it?
So, Mike, I'm going to take it from you there. Thank you. And Dr. Boucher, so I'm going to break out two pieces there. First, Mike asserted that you're more likely to be symptomatic if you're not vaccinated and have COVID-19, and you're more likely to be asymptomatic if you have been vaccinated. Just checking that with you, because we're laying that as an assumption. And then I do know the Biden administration is preparing to invest in making more take-home and at-home tests available. Do we need a more aggressive testing regime, even for those who are vaccinated? Dr. Boucher.
Yeah, so two important issues. I think first and foremost, I don't believe it is true that unvaccinated individuals more likely are symptomatic. They're more likely infected, for sure. And they're more likely to get serious illness and have bad complications. That's true. But both vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals have asymptomatic disease with COVID. Then the testing issue is a really good one. And tests are another important tool in the toolbox of getting us out of this mess with COVID. And so I am very, very gratified that the Biden administration is investing in these tests. And, you know, we've already seen their utility in our schools here in Massachusetts, where we have the test and stay, where our kids who are back at school, like my high school daughter, who's fully vaccinated, has been able to get a rapid test when she had a cold that was negative and stay at school. So the rapid tests are going to help us in order to get back to a normal life more quickly. And they definitely have a place in the armamentarium here.
And Dr. Asumu, I'm going to read you a little bit of reporting because we had this question from Mike on testing. I'm going to read you a little bit of reporting from WBUR's Deb Becker today. In response to staffing issues facing Massachusetts schools and prisons, Governor Charlie Baker is activating hundreds of National Guard members to assist staffers. The governor's office said Tuesday that 200 National Guard members will be deployed to help with COVID-19 testing in public schools. They're going to begin training this week, start assisting with tests on Monday. How important is that additional staffing? You know, when we see the National Guard mobilized, that also really communicates something about urgency. I just want to give you a chance to react to all that.
Yeah, no, although we've made progress, we're still in a pandemic. And I'm glad that we're actually using all the resources to make sure that testing is carried out and that we mobilize all the resources that we have. Because, you know, we keep, so number one, you know, vaccination. That's what we need to be doing. But testing is also a very important piece because we want to be able to identify those who are infected so that we can use mitigation measures. And masking is also important. So I think that we need to remember, although we're making progress, we're still in a pandemic and we need to use all the different tools that we have in our toolbox.
1-800-423-8255. This is Radio Boston. We are talking with Drs. Sabrina Asumu and Helen Boucher to ask your coronavirus questions. That's the number, 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Mary on the line in Brookline. Mary, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering, have they been able to tell if the breakthrough cases have been primarily from Pfizer or Moderna or JJ or all about the same?
Dr. Asumu, why don't I stay with you on that one? What do we know?
Yeah, no, this is a very important question. So the CDC stopped systematically sort of getting information on all breakthrough cases. They're focusing on the cases that require hospitalization. So that's where we actually have the best data. There seems to be, if you look at different states, some states seem to be reporting that there were more, so these are more like anecdotal and smaller sort of in different states. There seem to be more breakthrough cases with the J&J, but this is why we're eagerly awaiting the decision that's going to hopefully come this week in terms of the FDA decision about booster shots for J&J. So we really need that information. The mRNA seemed to have similar performance in terms of efficacy and performance so far from the data that I've seen. I don't know if Dr. Boucher has some additional data that she'd like to share.
Dr. Boucher.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I think we do have to be very careful as we look at these data because every report is somewhat different. And I, like Dr. Asumu, am really looking forward to this Thursday and Friday's meeting with the FDA advisors to get more information about what we know about boosters and breakthrough infections.
So on that, Dr. Boucher, before I go to the next call, when the FDA advisors meet, is there any word on whether they are, how do I ask this, with the Pfizer boosters, they were authorized for limited groups of people, and then that limited group grew over time. With Moderna and J&J, is this a blanket population that the FDA is considering, or are they going to begin by looking first at target groups? Do we know?
You know, I don't know. So I'm anxious to actually see the data that they review. But I will point out that the process is the FDA will review the data this week, and then there may be an authorization by the commissioner of the FDA, and then it will go to the CDC advisors, I think, in a couple of weeks, where they will make recommendations about who, if anybody, should receive those boosters.
And then any action would happen after that, correct?
Correct.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. 800-423-8255. We have Jillian on the line in Lexington. Jillian, go ahead and ask your question.
Yes, good afternoon. So I'm a special needs, a specialist as a speech pathologist, and obviously with kids that are somewhat compromised, that can't really comply with masks and they're worn incorrectly, and those kids are in very close proximity to us because we've been told that we're now down to, 3 feet. And there are some families that for medical reasons or for religious reasons have chosen to be exempt from, have their kids exempt from the vaccine. So my question is, at almost 64, with a little bit of immune compromise, am I safe in just a regular surgical mask, or is an N95, because some of these kids are in a 3 foot proximity range, recommended?
Jillian, are you vaccinated?
I am, and I had a booster as well.
Okay, thank you for that. Dr. Asumu.
Yeah, no, this is a great question. So number one, we want to use multiple layers. So I really love that Tiziana actually asked you, are you vaccinated? Because getting vaccinated is the best thing that you can do for yourself. And then the other layer is, wearing the mask, as you said. With the Delta variant, we've seen that wearing a better quality mask than like a cloth mask. So wearing either a surgical mask, and, you know, if you can tolerate it, those KN95 could be also be helpful. But I would say, you know, if you're in there with the kids, you want to wear a mask that you're going to tolerate. So I think a surgical mask, being vaccinated. And also the other thing to think about is ventilation. Like, what is the ventilation like in the space that you are? Is it possible for you to open the windows? Do you have a HEPA filter? So there's certainly a lot of things that we can do to sort of improve conditions and limit transmission in those cases.
1-800-423-8255 to ask your question. Lana is on the line in West Roxbury. Lana, go ahead with your question.
Hi. I'm 80 years old, and I've been vaccinated with the Pfizer. And my last vaccination date was 3/14/21. And I'm wondering whether for the booster shot, have too many months passed since my last vaccination for the booster to be, will I get help from the booster?
Great question, Lana. Dr. Boucher.
Yeah, so Lana, the good news is I think you're in very good shape to get your third dose now. So I would recommend that you go ahead and get it when you can.
Terrific. Let's grab another call here. We've got Nancy in Cape Cod. Nancy, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, quick question. Are the over-the-counter do-it-yourself test kits as reliable as if you, is it the same science, is it as reliable a result as if you were to go into a health facility?
If you went to like a lab and got it done, or a MinuteClinic, something like that. Thank you, Nancy. Dr. Asumu, how about these rapid at-home tests? What is their level of reliability, and how do they compare with, say, a PCR?
So first of all, you know, I'm really glad that we're talking a lot more about the home rapid tests, because having a test that you could get an answer really quickly and act on is going to be really important. The PCR tests that you get, let's say at a hospital facility or in a clinic or something, are more helpful in the sense that their sensitivity is best. But those home tests, like the antigen tests, are really good because they can answer the question, are you infectious right now? Which is a helpful thing to know. The good thing about them too is that, you know, you want to repeat those tests. And especially, you know, I have a 5-year-old who's in school, and it's been really helpful for me, you know, whenever she wakes up with the sniffles, to be able to get that test and know exactly what we need to do and get the confirmatory test later. But these tests are actually very helpful, and I'll encourage people to get as many as they can and get tested when they have symptoms.
Two clarifications there, Dr. Asumu. First, you said you want to repeat the tests. Just talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, no. So these tests, the home tests that the caller was talking about, are antigen tests as opposed to PCR tests, which check for like the genetic information. And so they're actually very helpful at answering the question, you know, are you infectious right now? But then, you know, the reason why you need to repeat them is to make sure that you're not infectious, let's say, like a day later or something. When you buy a kit one of the tests that I know you can buy over the counter, it actually comes with two that you can actually do. And so it's actually recommended that you repeat that test within 36 hours. So I believe that those tests are actually going to be a very important tool for us to get to the new normal, to be able to have access to them.
And just very briefly, if you test positive at an at-home test, then you're suggesting one should go somewhere and get a full PCR, correct?
Well, it's sort of it depends. Like, is it, you know, different people have different, if you're positive on those tests, it's often going to be positive, but you want to go and get it checked and confirmed with a PCR. For instance, your job may want you to have a a confirmatory test. Like, for instance, some of the protocols that I've seen, you know, if you're positive, you're done. So it sort of depends. You want to check with what particular protocol you have.
Thank you.
Where you are.
So, Dr. Boucher, I don't have time to go back to the phone, but I do want to ask a question from Shauna in Walpole. She has a son who is 12 and has received his first dose of the Pfizer vaccine. He has a really bad cough, and so she wants to delay his second shot. Can she do that?
You know, she can, but she doesn't need to. So, you know, first and foremost, she should have her son tested for COVID to make sure he doesn't have COVID. And see the doctor if there's anything, you know, more going on. But as the studies were conducted, there were people who were having respiratory symptoms who were vaccinated perfectly safely.
And in two sentences, Dr. Boucher, what are you watching for over the next week or two? What's the most important thing on your mind right now?
Oh, I'm watching these numbers and hoping they continue to go down, looking at hospitalizations especially, but really overall case counts and deaths, as we've seen really nice decreases in our country and in our state over the last 2 weeks.
All right. Thank you. And listeners, many of you, we didn't get to your calls. I know you're still calling in. We will continue to do Ask the Doctor. So if we didn't get to your questions this week, follow us again next Tuesday. We've just had Dr. Helen Boucher, infectious disease physician at Tufts Medical Center, interim dean of the Tufts University School of Medicine. Dr. Boucher, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Sabrina Asumu, assistant professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine and infectious disease specialist at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Asumu, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me on.
Offshore wind is set to make waves in New England, bringing jobs and renewable energy to the region. But how do we do this new industry right and fair? In a new series called Power Shift, The Promise of Offshore Wind, WBUR and E&E News look deeply at wind and what it means for us and for the world. The first part of that series is set to premiere tomorrow morning on WBUR's Morning Edition, but we're going to preview it now. And to joining us to do that, WBUR environmental reporter Miriam Wasser. Miriam, welcome back.
Hey, Tiziana.
So diving headfirst into offshore wind, Miriam,
yes.
Lots of hype in the past. I'm thinking of the storied history of Cape Wind, which, of course, in the end came to nothing. If I'm living in Natick, let's say, or New Bedford, is offshore wind about to affect my life?
Yeah, so I would say that the failure of Cape Wind definitely looms large over the industry, but it really does seem like we've turned a corner this time, and I think it really is happening. As to your second question, is it going to affect people's lives? The answer is yes. You know, over the next few decades, offshore wind, if it really gets built out, should decrease the price of electricity. So if you live in Natick, hopefully you see that reflected in your monthly bills. And bigger picture, sort of especially for someone maybe living in a place like New Bedford, this new industry is going to create a lot of jobs. And some of those will be in construction, but a lot of them will be in manufacturing or engineering and with the wind developers themselves. And New Bedford right now is largely known as a fishing hub, but in the future, it could be, you know, New England's offshore wind hub or one of the offshore wind hubs as well.
So it's coming. It's important. So let's dive in now to your reporting. There are three parts to look forward to over the next few days. Tell us about these three parts and how you picked them.
Yeah, so, well, you know, our original story list was a lot longer than three stories, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Fair enough.
Reality starts to set in, and you have to narrow things down. So the three topics that we chose really stuck out to us as big themes with big questions that we wanted to probe. And, you know, sometimes you start reporting a story with a sense of what you're going to find. And in the case of these three topics, I think we genuinely wanted to know the answers to these questions. So, you know, as a reporter, that's always really fun.
Mm-hmm.
The first story is about the promise of jobs. So if you follow environmental news, you've probably heard people, including our president, talk about the promise of green jobs. And with offshore wind, you know, states and the White House have put numbers to that. The White House says that if we build out 30 gigawatts of offshore wind by the end of the decade, which is essentially equivalent to like putting all of New England's power plants in the water, that could create up to 77,000 jobs. So that's a lot of jobs.
Yeah, that's
a lot. Yeah. And Ben and I wanted to know, like, what are those jobs? And are they going to be good jobs or minimum wage positions? Where are they going to be located? What sort of education or training are you going to need to get them? And then perhaps most importantly, who is going to get them? So one of the people that we talked to who I think really drove this home was a union rep named John Grossman. And we have a little bit of tape from him. As he noted, not all green jobs are necessarily good ones.
Creating jobs by itself is not the solution. The jobs have to be good jobs, and the people who need them have to be the ones who get them.
And, you know, just one more thought on jobs. Like as many supporters of offshore wind say, it's not every day that we build a whole new energy industry from scratch, but that is what we're doing with wind. And that means this is an opportunity to build environmental justice and equity into the industry early.
So Miriam, in a minute, I know you're going to tell us about the other two, but you mentioned Ben. Yeah. So I just want to note for listeners, that's Ben Storrow from E&E News, who worked on this series with you, right?
Correct. Yes. Ben Storer was my co-reporter and co-writer for this whole series. And he is, one of the authors of it.
Okay. So go ahead. Tell us briefly about these other two stories we're going to hear this week.
Yep. So on Thursday, you will hear a story about fishing and whether fishermen and wind can coexist. So the commercial fishing industry has really emerged as the biggest opponent of offshore wind in this country. And, you know, any story you read seems to have a quote from a fisherman or a fishing group outlining the threats that they say it will pose. And Ben and I going into this, you know, it seemed really far-fetched to us to say that offshore wind was going to, like, kill the commercial fishing industry, which is sort of the sense you get sometimes from reading these stories. So what we really set out to understand is, what do we actually know about the potential impacts? What fishermen in specific and fisheries in specific are going to be affected? And given that climate change is already impacting the ocean in really profound ways, what's the cost of doing nothing?
And are we going to find out that we know a good deal? Do we know what those potential impacts are?
Yeah. I mean, our big takeaway from that is that the vast majority of fishermen are probably not going to be affected by offshore wind, but there are some who will, and those who are affected are going to be greatly impacted. And for the most part, it's going to be the small operations, the one boat, the little individual, kind of like ma and pa style fishermen. In terms of ecosystem impacts, I think that there's a little bit more uncertainty about that as well.
But it's going to be really interesting to have you tell us, you know, those distinctions and tell us some of those individual stories. All right. So then big oil, right?
Yep. Number three is how big oil wants to become big wind. So some of the biggest oil companies in the world, like Shell and BP, are getting into offshore wind. And Shell, for example, is partially behind the Mayflower project, which is likely to be the second major offshore wind project near Massachusetts. And we wanted to understand, how seriously are these oil companies taking climate change and their promises to go green? You know, does getting into offshore wind represent an actual change to their business model, or is it an opportunity for them to greenwash?
And that one comes on Friday, right?
Correct.
Okay. So as I was preparing, looking at your reporting, et cetera, Miriam, I thought it was so interesting, just the pure range of places you saw, people you spoke with, that sort of the almost, obviously it was in print, but almost the sights and the smells and the sounds of reporting this. So bring us one or two of the most surprising or vivid scenes that you and Ben encountered.
Sure. And I'm very glad to hear you say that. We worked very hard to make sure that we were not just talking at a 30,000 foot level, but that we were introducing readers and listeners to real people.
Yeah.
So I think the first one that sticks out is probably the fishing boat. So we drove all the way to Montauk to spend a day on a squid fishing boat. And that was definitely an experience, I will say. I don't think either of us had been on a commercial fishing boat before. So just, you know, seeing how they do things was fascinating. But the specific boat we were on was owned by a fisherman named Dave Arapach. And he fishes from Nantucket to New Jersey, which is an area that's very much slated for wind development. And, you know, as I just mentioned a moment ago, one of our big takeaways is that it's the little guys like Arapach who are going to probably be the most affected and have the most to lose from offshore wind. So, you know, just as we watched him and his crew haul in these like huge nets filled with hundreds of pounds of fish and squid, you could just see in his eyes how much he truly loves what he's doing. And you can hear in his voice how hard it is to be a fisherman in 2021 and how scared he is of what's to come. So we have a little bit of tape from a conversation we had with him that we can play.
There's so many things going against you as a commercial fisherman in the United States. And now these wind farms, just it's almost like that's the final nail in the coffin. I hope I'm wrong. But, I mean, there's no young guys really that want to fish here anymore. And that's changed in the last 5 years. I mean, guys are just sick and tired of being kicked in the teeth.
And, you know, I think one of the things that I just love about this line from him is it really drives home the point that offshore wind development isn't happening in a vacuum. It's just one more thing in a series of hardships that he and other fishermen face.
All right. So give us one more, Miriam, one more. Introduce us to one more person or one more idea that really captured you.
Sure. So obviously we talk a lot in this series about jobs and the people who are getting jobs, and we set out to find who these people are. And that landed us at a class at the Mass Maritime Academy called Working from Heights. So this was a class for union workers, and in this particular day, it was all iron workers from across New England, and they were practicing using going up and down ladders. So, you know, a lot of the work they'll be doing out in the ocean is in these huge turbines, and they'll be hundreds of feet above the air at sea. So if they fall, they need to know what to do or how to rescue people. And a lot of these people will be out there on the ocean next summer constructing the Vineyard Wind project. And one of the people that we met was a guy named Billy Veets, and he is an iron worker from Roxbury. And I don't want to give away too much of his story because I want people to tune in tomorrow, but Veets is someone who just really believes in offshore wind as a climate solution. And here's a little bit of tape from him.
I'd like to be able to tell my son in the future that I was a part of doing something that helped reduce carbon emissions and just kind of be a part of this whole new industry of building a clean energy infrastructure in the United States.
And I'll give you one little more detail about Billy Veets. So we were also just really drawn to him because he had this really human moment where he told us that he wanted to help build Vineyard Wind because of guilt. So he helped build the controversial Weymouth Natural Gas Compressor Station a few years ago, which is a project that I know you and I have talked about a lot.
Yeah, you followed it closely.
And, yeah, and he feels really bad about that because natural gas creates a lot of methane and carbon emissions, and he sees offshore wind as a way to make it up to the planet, as he says. So It just really struck us because it's like not the sort of sentiment you would expect to hear from a really gruff guy with a hard hat and lots of tattoos.
All right. So, Miriam, last question. Series begins tomorrow. What do you hope people will take away from it?
Sure. So to me, I think the big takeaway is sort of where we started, in that it's not every day that we build an entirely new industry from scratch, right? And people want it to do a lot of good things, but it's not going to be easy, and there are going to be a lot of trade-offs. And I think in some ways it's a microcosm of trying to address climate change at large, right? It's messy and complicated, and there is no perfect solution.
All right. That is WBUR environmental reporter Miriam Wasser. Miriam, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And the series is called Power Shift, The Promise of Offshore Wind. It's a collaboration between WBUR and E&E News. You can listen to WBUR's morning edition tomorrow morning for the first installment of three over the next few days. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. When you poured your coffee this morning, you probably didn't think to yourself, hey, I have to adjust how I'm thinking about and addressing risk. Probably not, but the pandemic has us doing that all the time now, whether it's masks, vaccines, even whether to attend an indoor family meal. Well, retired General Stanley McChrystal thinks about risk all the time, too. He served as commander of International Security Assistant Forces in Afghanistan from 2009 to 2010, where risk assessment and response became a way of life. Now, McChrystal has a new book out that argues that we are our own worst enemies when it comes to assessing risk and responding to it. But the good news is we can do better. And interestingly, especially to us, one of the case studies he drew lessons from was Boston and our own COVID-19 response. The book is Risk, A User's Guide. Stanley McChrystal is a retired four-star general in the U.S. Army and is a senior fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. He joins us on the line now. General McChrystal, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you, General. There is a lot we want to talk to you about. I want to put a stake in the ground that before we let you go, given your extensive experience, I am going to want to get your sort of take on the withdrawal from Afghanistan back in August. But I want to start with risk and this new book. You use Boston and Mayor Marty Walsh's early response on the COVID-19 pandemic as a case study in the book. Let's do the same here. What did Mayor Walsh and the city get right about risk in those early days of the pandemic?
Well, it's an interesting story, and essentially what happened is as COVID-19 started to appear, I think all of us were uncertain as to what it was, how it would manifest itself as a threat to all of us. We all knew the term pandemic, but we really didn't understand much more than that. Mayor Walsh watched what was happening earlier in New York City, and then he had a fateful meeting with a friend in Boston. And in that meeting, he came away realizing that suddenly this was going to be a great big deal. But what do you do about it? You're not a medical guy yourself. You're not a public health expert. What he did first was he went to talk to some other people who could inform him more. And then he knew that he was going to have to lead the city in a different way. And what he was going to have to do was make decisions in a decisive way before information was open to everybody, meaning you have to make decisions in the face of a pandemic before the exponential growth is clear to everyone. That's what makes leadership hard in that environment. He also knew that he was going to have to bring together his traditional leadership of the city, the people who work for the city, but also a lot of non-traditional stakeholders. He needed to have streamlined, interconnected communication that operated faster than ever. And so he set up something called a crisis response forum. And led by his chief of staff, Catherine Burton, what they did is every morning at 8 o'clock, they convened a virtual call of all these different people in whose hands the fate of Boston really rested. And when we talk about the fate of Boston, we're not just talking about a business or something. We're talking about that at-risk part of the population, the single widows, the young children, everybody who in some way relies upon the delivery of food, the opening of shelters, schools, and whatnot. And he started to bring them into constant real-time coordination. And of course, what made it hard, they couldn't get in a gym and do it easily. No. They had to do it with teenagers leaning over their shoulders, teaching them how to use Zoom. And he focused on outcomes. He said, we've got to deal with this problem in real time, and we've got to focus on outcomes. And at the end of each meeting, he would say, now let's kick some butt today.
So, General, I'm the meeting that you talked about, that first meeting that Marty Walsh had, was with Eric Rosengren, the head of the Boston Federal Reserve Bank, who wouldn't shake his hand, which took him aback. And I want to bring that up because you're laying out a lot of really important leadership steps. But Mayor Walsh, early on, like many, also had to be brought to an understanding of the gravity of the situation. I mean, you talk about the Biogen conference in the book as well and its impact on spread. That happened in Boston, too. You know, as you point out, some countries were kind of already going hardcore on contact tracing, preparing for lockdowns. And we were still attending conferences, going to dinners, you know, in hotels and restaurants. So what other things like Rosengren did it take to make Mayor Walsh or other leaders say, whoa?
Well, it's interesting because you're right. He goes to see Eric, who refuses to shake his hand, even though they know each other well. And so that makes a big impression on Marty. And of course, you got to know Mayor Walsh, the kind of person he is. He's a union organizer turned politician, deals very well with people. And to suddenly have a different, awkward interaction made him stop and go, wait a minute, I got to pay attention. And then also remember that this was 6 years into Mayor Walsh's time as mayor, and he'd been through the big snow crisis in 2015, where he'd had to make really difficult decisions. So he had a frame of reference that said, there are times when you've got to be decisive, maybe make unpopular decisions and start moving. And you've got to bring your team, meaning your entire city, along with you, even though it may be unpopular at first. And so as he worked to do that, he understood that he had to communicate internally with this group, but he also had to communicate with the city. He had to tell people, all of the people who were involved in this, what the danger was and what we needed to do to deal with it.
So I want to stay on communication in general. You talk a lot about it in the book, and you can imagine it is near and dear to my heart. And as I was reading the Boston chapter, one of my vivid memories from the early days of the pandemic was actually covering Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker's daily press briefings. Mayor Walsh also did these regular press avails. How much of the focus on communication, when we get this right, General, is about frequency and transparency, and how much is about the actual message, or, you know, the term you use in the book often is narrative?
Yeah, I think they are all together. I think the most important first is transparency, and I'm going to use the term honesty. You've got to be clear and tell people what you actually know and admit what we don't yet know, because in the long term, that's what determines your credibility with people as a communicator. I think the second is communication's got to be frequent, but that's less important than the fact that the communication's got to be as right as you can make it. And so the ability to communicate in a changing environment in which people are uncertain and in many cases frightened is key. And leaders have to remember they aren't in control of communications. They are competing with 1,000 other sources of information, media, social media, people in the neighborhood, many of which are flawed. And so you've got to create communication with a strong narrative that is so clear and so powerful that it can compete with all this disinformation that often corrupts what people think about something.
Stay with that for a minute, General. Misinformation and disinformation. You talk about it some in the book. You've talked about it a lot in some other interviews. And given, you know, honesty as a core focus of communication, how hard is it for us as bodies of people, right, that make up organizations, we make up communities, we make up civic associations, to do what we need to do and respond to crisis, respond to risk, mitigate, if we are bathing in misinformation?
Well, it's extraordinarily hard, and I think it is maybe the greatest risk facing our society today. We have got suddenly this information technology miracle in our hands, and we haven't matured yet enough as a society on how to use it. And what I mean by that is we can all communicate faster than we can think, and we can do that, and we do that often. And then I would also say that just because you are an effective communicator doesn't mean you are honest and with good intentions. So people who are trying to create a very negative or skewed outcome can use exactly the same tools that someone with very good intentions has. So you get no points for being the better person on the higher ground. You've got to compete with that. And so I think we've got a crisis of misinformation, which I call things which are probably unintentionally incorrect, and disinformation, yeah, which is intentional lies and corruption. And I think those two things together really threaten the fabric of our democracy.
We are talking with retired four-star general from the U.S. Army, Stanley McChrystal. He is co-author with Anna Botrico of the new book, Risk: A User's Guide. General, there are a couple of other subjects. I mean, there are many subjects I'd like to get to with you, but we have time for a couple of others. And I am going to ask you a question that might be a little bit uncomfortable now, General, but it has to do with the lessons in this book. Your tenure in Afghanistan ended after a Rolling Stone article cited mocking comments that you and others in your staff made about civilian government officials. That included then Vice President Joe Biden. You apologized and you eventually resigned. And I wanted to ask you this. I wondered about this as I was reading through the book. Are there lessons about risk and communication, honesty, transparency from that experience that are reflected in this book?
Yeah, I think they are, probably not directly because I covered that instance in my memoirs, but I can describe it for people who don't remember that. That was at least in my life, that was an explosion when that story came out and ended my career. I didn't think that the story was accurate or fair. But in the moment, I was able to understand that didn't really matter. What mattered was, here I am, a military commander, and I have essentially caused a problem to be set upon my commander, the commander-in-chief, the president's desk. And that's not something that I should do. So I'm responsible for it. And so the first thing you do is accept that responsibility, which I did. I went, met with President Obama and offered to resign. He accepted my resignation. The second question you got to make is, what are you going to do about it? You know, I felt in my heart, and I probably naturally feel this way, that I had been wronged. But I also know that people didn't care. Most people wouldn't know that and wouldn't care. And if I wanted to be the aggrieved party, I could be a bitter old general for the rest of my life, and a certain number of people would take me out to lunch to hear that story. But the reality was, there's no point. Again, people don't care. What I had to decide to do in that moment was to live facing forward, to say, okay, that incident happened for which I was responsible. But what I can do from that moment forward is try to do the best I can in everything I do so that everyone who meets me, who also hears that story, goes, wow, I wonder about that, because this doesn't, the two don't seem congruent. And I would tell your listeners, almost everybody in your life is going to stumble. You're going to have a problem with a child, or you're going to have a failed marriage, or you're going to have a failed business, or you're going to do something wrong. You may end up in jail, whatever it is, it happens. And it's going to first and foremost test you in the moment, but then it's going to let you decide who you're going to be after that. And that ability to decide is a gift. It's a gift from, you know, wherever, that we have to grab and then decide that every day going forward, empowered with that, hopefully, wisdom, I'm going to do as well as I can.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer, General. You talked about facing forward, so let's face forward a minute now to Afghanistan today. Our longest military engagement, it ended over the summer in the dramatic collapse of the government there. We had a hasty withdrawal. Using the lens of your book, and we have just a couple minutes left, what did the U.S. leadership, President Biden, miscalculate about risk and vulnerability in that action?
I think this is separate from the decision whether or not to stay there. We're talking about how you extract now. I think they did a risk analysis, and they said that the best way to minimize risk was to move American forces out quickly to give any threats a limited window in which to attack them if they wanted to. The Taliban had agreed not to attack, but ISIS and al-Qaeda had every reason to want to try to hit the Americans going out. So I think the decision was based on that. I think it was probably a reasonable calculation that the Taliban would not be able to collapse the Afghan government as fast as they did, but there was a possibility, and that's what happened. I mean, there's a certain amount of fate in anything, and I think they just calculated that one and it came out wrong, and so it looked really messy and it was painful. I'm not saying it had to be that way, but sometimes it is, and I think that they did a pretty good job of picking up the pieces once they got caught a bit flat-footed there at the airport in Kabul.
So, General, I'm mindful. I have time for like a one-sentence answer from you on this. One thing individuals could take from your book to practice in their own lives.
You own it. You're not a victim. You have the authority and the ability and the responsibility to make yourself stronger.
That is Stanley McChrystal, a retired four-star general in the U.S. Army, served as commander of the International Security Assistance Forces in Afghanistan from 2009 to 2010. General McChrystal is a senior fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute of Global Affairs. The book, along with Anna Butrico, is Risk, A User's Guide. General, so informative. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Boston.
It was my honor. Thank you.
Appreciate it. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, Cynthia Betubiza, and Jack Mitchell. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer, Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening today. Thanks for calling today. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.